Hello and welcome to I Am the Egg Pods with me, Chris Shaw. Throughout January 2022, a potpourri of delicious guests are taking a jaunty stroll through Peter Jackson's Get Back, day by day, every day, on the day. In this episode, it's a welcome return to broadcaster, writer and podcaster, Julia Rayside. Hello.
Hello. It's nice to see you again. It's been about, what is it, 2 years since we did our in-person recording? Longer than that, probably.
It was a week before lockdown.
Wasn't it? Yeah. It was like the end of human contact as we know it.
It was. I think that was the last time I went to a pub prior to the lockdown. And we were surrounded by a load of drunk people.
It was awful. You were really hungover. They were really drunk. It was like, it was a bit dystopian. It wasn't like a lovely, happy way to leave society, was it? It was a warning of what was to come.
It was. So, Get Back. Did it exceed your expectations? Did you have any expectations?
I live in a house with someone who is much more invested in this than me. I love it. I love them. I was looking forward to it. I was sort of coming from it. I was coming to it from a point of view of being someone who really loves television. And I will watch. I will admit this now. This is not the thing to say on a Beatles podcast. Like, I've never missed an episode of Made in Chelsea. I'm just going to say that. And then you'll probably switch off or judge me as you will. But I on the whole, I sort of don't like constructive reality TV. But I like that one because it's so constructed. And this didn't feel like watching Made in Chelsea, obviously. But it did feel constructed in a way. There were lots of reminders of, obviously, you know, it opens with that. The famous kind of announcement of numerous editorial choices, which is kind of how they start any modern reality show now. It's like, this represents reality. Some scenes have been constructed for your entertainment. It's very, you know, how they pull up some of the audio and fade down some of the others. And you're never quite sure if what you're watching is what really happened. But it's so pleasurable. You kind of don't really care. It's kind of, it's hitting all your pleasure centres. So you're just enjoying being in the room with those men. As Nadine Shireen pointed out, at their absolute hottest. Sorry.
It's been mentioned a few times.
Yes,
should we get it over and done with? Go for it.
Let's get it out of the way. All I want to say is that had she been given this episode to discuss, then I wouldn't have known when she was watching it, except for there would have suddenly been like a mushroom cloud over Brighton as Paul dandled his stepdaughter on his knee and put her on his shoulder. It's too much. My ovaries couldn't cope. It was too much. Yes, out the way now. I think I can talk about it sensibly now without getting all flustered. Sorry.
Thing is, I'm going to get going in a minute. So let's go in. It's day 17 and it's a Sunday.
Yes.
They're going in on the Sunday, 26th of January.
I like their dedication. I like that they're working all the hours, even the Lord's Day. God bless them.
Well, they haven't worked any weekend so far. I think the reality is hitting them that they're apparently the plan at the moment is to perform on the rooftop in just 3 days' time.
Yes, 3 days' time. I mean, looking at it, I mean, it's the Beatles. They can do anything, but it does seem unrealistic, doesn't it? And obviously the day I got to do, which it was so joyful, is kind of, I suppose it's sort of dubbed Family Day. It's, even though some of these recordings went on to appear on Let It Be and things, it's so kind of chaotic and lovely. And half the time, like, they're babysitting Heather, Paul's new girlfriend's daughter. And it's just, it's so delightful. And it's so interesting watching how each of them interacts with Heather. That's kind of the main focus of this little nugget. It's so telling and so interesting.
It really is. So George and Ringo, they're the first to arrive, and we hear an unreleased George song which he's playing to Mal called Window Window, which is very Bob Dylan.
Yeah, something about a girl with a curl. It's sort of like, clearly there's some distant childhood nursery rhyme memory there that he's just sort of channeling into a song. Yeah,
I love it because Mal's kind of taking the piss out of it. Because the lyrics are, I once knew a beautiful girl. She had long blonde hair and a curl.
Yeah.
Mal's a curl. And it's also George's Liverpudlian accent. He's trying to get away with rhyming care by pronouncing cur.
Yes. Like Cilla Black.
Yes.
There was a lot of that in her era, wasn't there? But yeah, it's this is just literally pre-titles over the titles, isn't it? You're kind of, I almost missed it the first time I watched it. I sort of didn't really pay attention to it and then went back. And it's just playful. And it goes on, you know, to be then a little scene between George and Ringo. And it's almost like the kids playing before mum and dad arrive. It's just really
good.
The whole thing is a family. The Beatles suddenly become, or not suddenly, but it becomes really obvious that they're a family and who's mum and who's dad And it's just, yeah, the whole thing is just, there's so much to say about it. We'll never get it all into one podcast. We'll try. We'll try.
We will. And there's just a, before that, there's a tiny little bit of editing by Peter Jackson, which I really enjoy. Two policemen on horseback passing by.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like a premonition of what's to come.
Exactly. It's like they're on Savile Row. That's where the kind of the titles and the green script appear, Get Back. And you're just watching these two police officers. A little, I mean, if we were doing textual analysis in my English degree, it'd be like, oh, it's prefiguring what's to come. But it is, it's a lovely, especially if you're watching again, it's your first little tickle, a little reminder of like, oh, you know what's coming? It's the Keystone Cops. It's going to be so much fun. Yeah, it's lovely. It's just beautifully done. Beautifully done.
And Ringo's chatting to Glyn Johns, who's wearing that coat.
He's wearing his sort of like fluffy Afghan rug. And those sunglasses at one point, they kind of fly-like sunglasses. Obviously indoors. Everyone else, the Beatles look kind of quite low key, but Glyn is never off duty. He's never off. And I really enjoyed later on that Heather, the kid, really gravitates towards him and says she wants to marry him. And I have a theory about why, but we'll discuss that when we get to it.
Ooh, interesting. And yeah, as you said, yeah, George and Ringo. Ringo's at the piano. George is asking him, first of all, if he's had time to finish the lyrics for a song he's been working on called About Picasso.
Yeah, which is a bit out there.
A snippet. Well, yeah. It's bootlegged as I Bought a Picasso, and you can hear snippets on the 3rd of January. But yeah, he was better with his next one, which he plays Octopus's Garden.
Yeah, you sense that's where his heart is. Perhaps not in like abstract art, more in like, so there's this octopus, right? And he's got a garden. I have to apologise now that I sometimes do bad accents. And it's like a tick. Okay. I can't help myself. But yeah, he's clearly, he wants to do. Again, it's like the kids are playing and you can see it in the look, especially on George's face. When the two grown-ups eventually do arrive, there's a slight, almost guilty, yeah, we're just mucking about with this like silly kids song. But it's so cute. So he plays, was it, what, 2-3 bars of Octopus's Garden standing at the piano in this kind of like pinstriped jacket. But Ringo looks amazing. We have to talk about the eyebrow. God, I went down an eyebrow hole on the internet.
It's just so,
because there's so many theories about why he's got a weird eyebrow. Obviously, when I see him and like he's the kid of the family, like clearly it's like, oh, Ringo shaved his eyebrow off, you know. No, but there's a theory that it's either a grey patch that he used to ink in when he was on stage, like he used to draw it in with eye pencil, or a tambourine got thrown at his head. John threw him a tambourine, it hit him in the face and he had to have stitches. And then he came back on stage with his head bandaged. That's enough. But I don't even know why he's got weird eyebrows, but it's like his quirk, his visual quirk.
I never would have noticed that.
No! Oh my God, his eyebrow is so noticeable. How could you not notice it?
I don't know.
I just kept staring at it.
He went grey. I mean, he was going grey for Please Please Me.
Well, there was always that sort of streak in his hair. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The Dickie Davis.
Exactly. So some theories say his eyebrow mimicked his, like, it's like a microcosm of his head at large, like this little grey stripe. But I can't, even if I peer at it really closely, it's like, I don't know. It looks like he shaved it off. But anyway, yeah. Who knows?
I can't wait to see that. And there's a lovely little comment by George. And it sounds really patronising, but it's so sweet because he says, oh, I see you've learned A minor.
But I think he means it nicely, though. I think there's such a tenderness between the two of them that even though that kind of... So he's playing through Octopus's Garden. George immediately is there. Well, it's cut to George is there with the guitar, playing along, helping him write it. And then he's... You know that thing where... I was talking about this earlier with my husband, where you're trying to... Because you already know how a song goes, you're waiting for them to get there, but you're watching them get there in real time. So it's just like, ah, no, not like that. So you're kind of feeling this slight frustration of, look, we know how this song goes. Can you just play it properly? And then George is so patient with him. He's like, no, resolve it. It's like, bring it back to, no. So just resolve it. And he says it a few times, but he's being so patient and so lovely that it just sort of, it made my heart burst a bit.
Yeah. Well, again, it's another family analogy because then George Martin comes over and he's very much the father watching his kid ride a bicycle for the first time.
Yes. It's like sort of the quiet pride almost. And he's quite sort of in the background for this bit, but still such a presence, isn't he? Doesn't have to say anything. Mm. He's just a really, you know, Gandalf, like this lovely presence. Just keeping everyone safe.
So many people have said that.
Yeah,
it's
no,
amazing.
He emanates this... This quiet, maybe it's just being posh and British and tall and rangy, but that there's something very quietly beautiful and confident about him. He never has to try very hard. That's always appealing, isn't it?
So then John and Yoko arrive. John's keen to join in as well, so he's saying, "Shall I go? I'll go on drums.
Straight on.
Got to
have
a cigarette first."
Yeah, exactly. He's like, "I'm having." What does he say? I'm going to have a ciggy in my mouth to get on the kit or something. And so he goes and gets a fag and sits behind the drums. And they joke about Paul. Maybe Paul should be on the drums with his strong left arm.
Yeah.
But it's the look. Even before he sits down, it's when you see it's quite a moment. Like John and Yoko have walked in. John sort of in white, flowing white sort of top with obviously his long hair, and he just sort of comes in a bit sort of quite noticeably, and the Octopus's Garden is still going on, and George just looks a bit sheepish. Like he's smiling, but it's like, oh yeah, we just thought we'd have a bit of a muck about. And then rather than do what perhaps in a sitcom a dad would do and say, "What's all that?" He just comes and joins in, and it's just really charming. You kind of think, "Oh, good. I thought maybe it would be," because obviously there's that thing about John being in a good mood means everyone's in a good mood. There's some strange power he has over the room, and so when even as a viewer, when you're watching John and you think, "Oh, good, he's in a good mood," you kind of relax because you know you can enjoy the Beatles being mates again, which is the whole point of this film. It's like, "Oh, good, they're getting on. Oh, good, oh, good, oh, good."
Yeah, because there's a quote. I mean, on the Nagra tapes, lots of quotes from various Beatles. They keep using the phrase "the four of us."
Yeah,
the four of us. It's one of the reasons George put down his stipulations for rejoining the band. Kept saying about the four of us, i.e., not Yoko,
right?
Because she was very. She would basically speak for John at this time.
Really?
Well, I'm thinking about this. You know, obviously we all love Yoko, but there was an interview with Julia Baird, John's sister.
Yeah.
And she was saying that when John and Yoko got together, she all but lost all contact with them, primarily because they moved away, so they weren't local, especially when they went to America.
Yeah.
But when he had his lost weekend in 1974, then they made contact again. Paul made contact with them as well.
Aww.
And then when he reunited with Yoko, she lost contact. But what she said I thought was really insightful, and you don't really hear it. She said she wasn't angry with Yoko. She was angry with John for allowing himself to be so dominated.
Well, exactly. It's really weird. So it's like trying to psychoanalyze. It's so impossible, is it? They're such an impenetrable pair. And you could say, oh, is it a narcissist with someone who's sort of manipulated? Or is it two narcissists? Or is it they're not narcissists at all, but they've just got this unknowable connection, which means the rest of the world just sort of disappears. It's very hard to understand what's going on. And it's obviously with all the baggage that women who go anywhere near the Beatles come with, it's incredibly hard just to watch this. And, you know, a lot of the time you're just seeing the back of her head, her in profile, just always, you know, inches away from John. It's hard to watch the whole thing and not go, "What's she doing?" But then the more you watch the whole of this, the more you understand that at some point she had a really important function, like she just did her primal scream shit and everyone went, "Oh, good, yes," and started bashing their instruments to kind of let out whatever it was that was in there. And she's such an odd, obviously she's deliberately and sort of unknowable and odd. Have you ever seen her do, I mean, she's done lots of stuff like this, but there's a really interesting video of her doing the cover of Katy Perry's Firework in that art gallery in, I think, New York.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, yeah, so that's your thing. Right, okay, so just basically making strange noises. That's your thing. Okay, I don't understand it, but fine. That's your thing. It's hard not to watch her and just be like a knee-jerk misogynist about, like, why can't his girlfriend just get the message and, like, bugger off? Especially in what we've just watched, what we're talking about now. Obviously, Linda's about to enter, and she is such a different energy, a different presence in the studio, isn't she?
Yeah. What we must mention is the fact that Peter Jackson's cut out pretty well every time Yoko speaks.
Yeah.
She is so
mute, which again is strange because you can't really get a handle on her, what she's doing there.
Mm. Paul, Linda and Linda's six-year-old daughter Heather arrive.
Yes.
And the dynamics change again.
They do, but not as... I think there was more of a kind of disturbance in the force when John comes in, and then when Paul comes in, it's a different vibe. He comes in, he's at the front holding Heather's hand. They're completely affectionate. They're obviously so comfortable. I don't know how long Paul and Linda had been together.
Not long at all.
But it's just, I mean, obviously I could spend hours talking about just how incredible it is to be a Beatle, to be not just a Beatle like at the beginning of their career, it's 1969, you can have anyone you want and you fall in love with this woman, with a child, you know, you want family. You're not gravitating towards endless groupies and or whatever. He wants a family. It's just so... there's something so beautiful about that, to be in his shoes and to go, I love her. And it's and she just seems to fit into their world so seamlessly. And she's a photographer, she hangs back. But I think their entrance into this scene is kind of very, you know, he's a real presence as well, but it's much more just hello and off we go. And the cut after it is they're straight into just being really comfortable in the studio. Heather's there. It basically becomes a creche after that in the nicest way. And she's very much centre of attention for lots of it. But they all take it in their stride. It doesn't feel like an annoying kid's come in to put them off their stride. It's just it's lovely. Lovely.
It really is. And I love seeing, because we've seen some of them anyway, the anger from the various pieces. We've seen George, how snarky he can get.
Yeah.
And she literally marches over to him, I'm a tame tiger, meow. And his response is, I'm cool with that.
Yeah. By then they've all, like, I don't know, done some psychedelics. They're like, yeah, talking nonsense is totally our thing. We're comfortable with you. But it's so interesting to see how the different Beatles react to her. And after she announces that she's a tame tiger, she lies on the floor and she tells the room about they've got newborn kittens only a few days old. And then straight away John's like, he's strangely dead behind the eyes at this point. I know he's just sort of joshing with her, but it's a slightly chilly joshing. And he's like, you should eat them. And she's like, don't be daft, you know, you can't go eating kittens. And he's like, oh, some people do. And he sounds the least delighted with her. He's still being very playful. But I think he takes longer to warm up to her being there, I think.
It's sort of Brothers Grimm humour, isn't it?
Yes.
You put pastry around them and you can have cat pie.
Yes,
but
yes.
I don't know if you've seen Magical Mystery Tour when little Nicola sits on his lap.
Oh, no, no.
Oh, it's a very similar thing. Basically, she was the daughter of one of the passengers on the coach.
Yeah.
And she just stayed for the whole filming. And there's a scene where George and John are sitting on the coach and she just sits on his lap. And he's sort of joking around with her, have a balloon or something like that. And he's have a balloon. She's giggling away. But that's his, I wonder if he was like that with Julian as well.
Yeah, you wonder what kind of,
he was completely different with Sean.
I can't imagine like exactly what kind of parent he was, but it's just, yeah, I imagine very funny, very dry. But yeah, with somebody else's kid. And obviously, I'm a parent, but especially when all of my contemporaries had small children, I didn't love other people's kids. I found them a little bit like, but obviously if my son said something delightful, I'd be like, oh my God, it's amazing. He's so fun. You know, you do love your own children more than you love other people's. Yeah. I just got a faint kind of, he wasn't quite invested in the way that obviously we see her later playing with Ringo and obviously just Paul just being, she climbs over him like a climbing frame and he's completely at ease with it. It's just, it's a different way of being around a kid, isn't it? To try and just say something to make them react. Mm. It seems more for him than her. That's probably an overanalysis of it, but like, he's amusing himself, but he's not really thinking about who he's talking to, I think.
Yeah. John obviously knows the feelings towards Yoko from the other three.
Yeah.
But I think John had a similar feeling about Linda as well. He's made a few comments over the years.
Yeah.
So for then Linda's daughter to arrive, that's reaffirming there's a definite wedge between him and Paul now.
Yeah.
He's going in the family direction.
Totally.
John's going the avant-garde. And it's not just a wedge between them. They're just heading both in separate directions.
It's like looking at any kind of long-term relationship. They obviously want different lives. Like, they're in that room with a common objective, but outside of there, it's like, yeah, Paul wants family, settling down. He wants to be in that lovely, warm, kind of easy place. And John wants the challenging, kind of unusual sort of romantic partner who pushes him to places he's never been in. They're looking in two completely different directions, different horizons, I suppose. And it makes it really clear. But it's really hard not to notice how Linda, it's brilliant. For about the first maybe 5-6 minutes of this clip, there's no Linda. Like, she just isn't in the edit because she's sitting at the side, or maybe she's hovering back and taking a couple of snaps. But she's so unobtrusive. She's so the opposite physically in the room of Yoko that it looked like, because Heather's all over the shots, she's everywhere. She's from one Beatle to the next, having a lovely time. It looks like Linda's like, look, I've got some stuff to do. The Beatles, could you just mind my kid for half an hour while I go and get my shit done? Yes. I'm like, this is effectively now a creche and some of it ends up on an album. That's like mind-blowing. They were basically charged with looking after someone's kid while they tried to make this. It's amazing. It's just so amazing. I love it.
Yeah. I love the end, the conversation between John and Heather's final comment is, "You don't eat any cats. They don't taste good. And anyway, I'm just a pussy cat that was just born." That's conversation over.
Exactly.
And that's sort of like something Yoko would say.
Well, kind of, exactly. But, you know, it's that sort of very direct child's logic. It's like, don't be silly. And that's what I mean about, because actually she knows exactly what she's saying. And imagine you're a kid. You've just got two kittens. Like, it's amazing you've even managed to leave the house because you're too excited to have two kittens. Mm. And the lack of, this is such a tiny thing, the lack of empathy it shows to say to someone who's just like, basically, I've just had the best thing ever happen to me. Oh, why didn't you eat them? That, it just shows no empathy at all. Because obviously that kid's going to be like, because I love them. Because why are you saying that? Because I love them. It's such an odd joke to make. And she handles it really well. She's like, well, because I'm a kitten and you can't eat me, don't be stupid. Love it. I love her. I really loved her. I just thought she was great.
Yeah. There's a section here. I can't remember if it was used or not, but I thought I'd mention it, where John says to Paul, hey, did you dream about me last night? And Paul says, I can't remember. And John said, yeah, it was a very strong dream. We both dreamt about it. It was amazing. Different dreams, you know, but I thought you must have been there because I was touching you, not in a sexual way. And this was the point where John believed in telepathy.
Ah.
And he basically is saying to Paul, I dreamt about you last night, so you must have dreamt about, you must have been there.
And again, that's such a, and obviously, you know, it comes from a slightly avant-garde place, but it's that point of view thing again, isn't it? It's like, well, it happened to me, so it happened to you. It's like, well, I was playing with the kittens. I don't think it did happen. It's very, I can't see another's point of view. It's a strange thing that he's got going on. Yeah, it comes up a lot. Let's psychoanalyze him. This is brilliant. I love this. I'm an expert. I'm trained. I'm not trained. I don't know what I'm talking about. But it is interesting, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. So then we get a rehearsal of Let It Be, and it's a welcome return to Billy Preston, who was unavailable the previous day.
Yeah, so suddenly at this point, visually, there's too much beauty in the room. At this point, obviously, he's wearing this really bright colours. He's insanely beautiful, you know, on a par with Paul or anything. There's suddenly too much beauty, and I sort of have to, you know, I have to squint until they cut away from him. It's a very good looking room. I'm sorry, I promise I wouldn't do this. I'm sorry. Sorry.
Again, Heather's the star of this. She's now got Glyn's coat on.
Yes.
And you see her mouthing along to Whisper Words of Wisdom.
Yes. It's a little unselfconscious moment where the camera finds her. And she's just sort of almost like in the old days of those early Beatles films, where you just see a girl in the crowd amongst all the screaming girls, but she's gazing at them and she's kind of just lost in the Beatles. She almost kind of echoes one of those teenagers who's just like gone, absolutely gone. But she's just lost in a moment, and it's beautiful because it's a kid and it's very honest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pete Perfidi's was on before, and he was saying about how music when you're a kid is just completely different experience.
Completely. And it really plugs into you. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I wonder if she actually, if that wasn't caught on film, would she remember that? I imagine she would, because it's just a moment of connecting with sounds and, you know, in a kind of she probably wasn't in a recording studio very often. Like, it must have been such a memory for her. I really want to like talk to her now and ask her all about it.
Yeah.
I want to know everything.
Yeah.
What was it like?
She's sitting on Paul's lap. No. And as you said, yeah, they're clearly very close. But then we see her with Ringo, and you know he's going to be good with kids.
This is my favourite thing. And I already know what you're going to say, and you can say it or I can say it, but the minute they're side by side, that they're side by side, then he gives her sticks. I think she's hitting the cymbals while he's tapping away at the rest of the kit, and you realise immediately, because you can't not, they're dressed identically.
Yes.
There's like flowery shirt, some kind of tan leather jerkin over the top.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, did you call each other? And it's like Kids Corner. Again, it's a family. The Beatles are a family. The grown-ups are getting on with the important stuff. And he does that thing where does she hit one of the drums, and he pretends to like leap out of his skin. And he's so good with her, and so kind of, but again, very at ease with her. He's not trying to tap dance and show off for her, but he's just really comfortable, but it's like another kid's come to join a kid who's already in the room. That's what it felt like. It's just, and they look like twins. It's just perfect. So lovely.
Like you say, yeah, Ringo, let's play along. She's just sort of tapping the hi-hat.
Yeah, she's doing it pretty well.
Yeah,
she's keeping in time, like perfectly. She's great.
Yeah. And I'm sure some of this is Peter Jackson editing.
Yeah.
Because it's just too perfect where at the end of the song, Paul says, yeah, a bit loud on the hi-hat. And, yeah. You know, and Ringo looks... Oh. And she does this big sort of guilty grin up at Ringo.
Oh. It's just lovely.
I think that must be a bit of editing, but it's a
lovely I think so. And you can kind of there are tiny moments in this where, because it's so well done, and obviously the way it's shot, you know, originally you're feeling like you're in the room with these people and you're kind of just quietly watching, like you could be there, and they're not really acting like you're there. And then occasionally there'll be one of the many editorial choices will kind of just jerk you back into this is cameras. People are where they're performing. You know, it's just, there's subtle reminders every now and then. Yeah.
Mm. John's very invested. He's on one of his good days, I think. He's suggesting doing a gospel ending for the song.
Yes.
Which I think would be amazing.
Would be brilliant, yeah.
He's clearly mentioned, because he says he compares it with Elvis. So I think they've all been watching the Elvis comeback special.
Definitely, yeah.
And there's a lot of similarities between the ethos of this and that, I think.
Yeah. And there's talk later about, obviously there's all these disagreements about what kind of thing they're actually making, and George Martin wanting it to be proper, and then Paul talking about strings and brass on a couple of tracks. It's like, you forget this little band of people in this very pared down room can make such a sound, you know, depending on the choices they make. And yeah, God, the gospel thing would have been mind blowing. Really good. Someone should just do that.
Yeah.
Is that sacrilege? Someone should just add a gospel choir. It'd be lovely.
So next we cut to Yoko Jam, which actually sounds like a breakfast.
Like a very, very unusual tasting thing you'd put on your toast and go, ooh, is this
a taste of clouds.
Yeah, is it fermented clouds? It's very unusual. Yoko Jam.
Yes, I want somebody please do that.
It's really odd. And so there's, again, brilliant, brilliant editing and probably a little bit dishonest. But she does... and again, I sort of watched this out of context. So she puts, you know, her mouth really close to the mic and just starts making Yoko noises in the, you know, or a long note, but it's not really it's like a cat, let's be honest. And then it cuts to Heather just kind of looking at her like, huh? And it's it's a real moment of comedy because the kid's like kind of echoing what you might be thinking if you were not entirely on board with Yoko's brand of... I'm putting air quotes around music. Like she's, you know, she doesn't hear the same music we do. Like her notes are not of this universe, I think is probably the best way to describe it. And it's just, it's very odd, but everyone's just used to it. So there's no other reaction in the room apart from the kid who's like, what is she? But it is really funny.
That's the thing I love about Heather being in there is the fact that we've been watching this from day one and we're kind of used to all their foibles and peccadillos. You put a kid in there, they're going to cut through all the bullshit.
Completely.
What is that noise?
Exactly. And even just the point of slightly debasing, you know, Glyn, like putting his coat on and stuff. It's like you suddenly look at him in a slightly different way. Like right at the beginning, I was like, wow, that guy's so cool. And then she kind of puts on his like amazing Muppet coat. And it's just like, oh, yeah, that's a bit. Why is he dressed like that when everyone else is just really uncomfortable in their own skin? Like, what's he doing?
It's a rock star.
Might be
thing,
a controversial. Yeah. But my theory about why she's so fascinated by him is it's 1969, so Sesame Street has begun. Obviously, the Muppet show is yet to come, but the Muppets have already started to appear. Like, certainly on American TV, and I don't know how recently, like, Heather and her mum have come from the States, but if she's seen a Muppet, she's going to love Glyn, because he looks like a frickin' Muppet. He does. He looks like a Jim Henson creature, and maybe that's why she's so drawn to him and wants to marry him later. Like, it's just just a theory.
That's brilliant. Mark Lewison.
Honestly, I can't believe the guy hasn't covered it yet, because, you know, it just seems to be obvious to me.
Then we get another jam, this time led by George and Billy Preston, really. And it's fantastic. I told you before.
Yeah.
Very Latin Santana sounding song.
Yeah, it's a totally different vibe, isn't it?
Yeah, which later would appear in Here Comes the Sun.
Yes, yes. I only know that because you wrote me some notes before this and I was like, oh yeah, I didn't realise that. And I could pretend that I had, but I didn't. I didn't realise that.
Somebody mentioned it on Twitter, actually. Ah. I can't remember who you are, so thank you, because I'd never noticed it before.
Yeah. Amazing. Also, we missed Heather then, obviously, after going, what the heck, she mimics Yoko. Then she basically puts the microphone in her mouth and starts going, ah, I'm not putting the microphone in my mouth, but that's sort of what it would sound like if I had. And it's just, again, it's just, she's such a, her comic timing is brilliant, absolutely impeccable.
Yeah. And then we have Digit. This is eventually one that we will, in very edited form here on Let It Be.
Yeah.
And with George Martin on maracas. And it's actually quite like this one because of the vibe in the room.
Yes, it's sort of like it's building. I don't, and it's really hard to tell whether it's just the music that led the editing. I'm imagining it did. But it's like this sort of bacchanalian thing and Paul's chucking Heather in the air. And it's and John and Yoko are dancing. It was the one moment where you see the two of them and think, ah, that's nice. Because the rest of the time she's just hovering like something out of a horror, like hovering in the corner. But it's a really nice moment of tenderness between them rather than just her always being at his shoulder. And it's sort of like it turns into a real party in the editing. Yeah.
Yes. Oh, yeah. It's like a little montage, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think that's why, because Glyn Johns originally put it in his Get Back album that was unreleased. And I think it's because he was there. He remembers, oh, that was so much fun that day.
Yes, yeah.
And his perspective's kind of taken. And of course, it was much longer on that version as well.
Yes, yeah.
And Phil Spector edits it down. And you think, there's no context. What is this?
Exactly. You had to be there. That's why it works, because that atmosphere must have been amazing. That everyone was in a good mood and that kid seemed to open up something in some of them. And it's a lovely moment. But yes, it's probably the most edited bit of the whole segment that we're talking about, I think.
Oh, yeah. And George Martin at the end, the father, come on, let it be.
But yeah, because it's George Martin, you don't mind him kind of cracking the whip a bit, because he does it so almost quietly and sort of unassumingly, but he knows he's in charge, kind of. It's just Melly has to whisper and everyone goes, oh, okay, righto.
Yeah.
Such power.
I don't know if you've seen that Harry Enfield clip where they're doing the Beatles and Kevin Eldon's playing George Martin.
Yes, yes, that impression's amazing. The voice, perfect.
But there's a moment in that that's very similar to this. It's like, come on, I'm not even going to attempt to do
no,
it.
No, don't even try.
But it says, no, be serious now, chaps.
And you just would straight away, wouldn't you? Doesn't even have to raise his voice. You just go, yes, George. Sorry, George. Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah. Oh, there's more procrastinating. They've only got 3 days to prepare for this, as far as they know.
Yeah.
But then they do really good versions of Blue Suede Shoes, Shake, Rattle and Roll.
Yeah. Which kind of surprised me, but I guess, you know, because they're not playing live at this point, they just need to riff. And it seems to be they'll do things that they all sort of know because of muscle memory and having played them and heard them, you know, for years and years. But there's a really nice moment. I think Shake, Rattle and Roll is sort of first. And there's a really, again, this is one of those moments you go, oh, I'm watching an edited shot thing where Linda's been pretty much invisible up to this point. Then you just see the side of her hair in profile with the camera in front of her face, you know, the shutter ready to click. And then it cuts to her POV, the camera's looking down her camera lens and the shutter goes a couple of times. And you're seeing some of those famous pictures that, you know, she took there. And it's such a small, subtle moment, but it's a lovely edit. It's just, here's her point of view. Don't forget you're watching her. Watch it, sort of like, you know, this, we're watching her, watching them. It's a really brilliant moment, I thought.
Oh, yeah. And then we move on to rehearsal for Long and Winding Road.
Yes.
Decidedly unenthusiastic.
Ringo takes a nap. Which is like, there's no drums in this, is there? Just like has a little snooze against the wall. And the kid, Heather and her mum are just slumped on the floor, kind of just stretched out. She's obviously, you know, overexcited herself, is getting a bit tired. And it just totally changes the vibe. And Paul's kind of, it's become quite serious again, I guess, because Heather's not taking up their attention as much. Paul's kind of schooling John about his too many notes on the bass. And I actually really enjoyed watching John play the bass. I don't think I've ever really watched him do that before. I think I'm just so used to seeing Paul doing it that I quite enjoyed. I love him on the bass. really like, and I love him on the bass in this especially, and he slightly takes the piss, doesn't he, when he's doing the those slow opening twangs at the beginning of the song.
Yeah,
he kind of mugs and kind of moves around a bit like a, you know, he's taking the mickey. But I love the sound he makes on that bass. It's gorgeous.
Oh yeah. And then they keep, because the Glyn sort of shouts out, they're just about to do a, well, I think they think they're already doing a take.
Yes.
Glyn's shouting out, shall I do a take? Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then that caption appears, this performance appears on the album,
it's,
Let It Be.
It's so nuts.
Wow.
It's so nuts.
Obviously prior to the overdubs, but
yeah, and
it's that version.
And as he asks, doesn't he sort of say, you know, Paul or guys or something? And Paul's in the middle of singing the lines. He just goes, yes, Glyn Johns. Like, I can't even remember which bit of the song it is, but he basically sings his name into the thing in a way you just say, God, if there were ringtones back then, that would be my ringtone. It's amazing. Yeah. He's singing my name. But it's very, yeah, it's so casual. They're like, oh, yeah, I suppose we should do a take. And Paul's not irritated that he's been stopped and then has to start again. He's just like, yeah, guess so. I can't get over how comfortable that guy is in his own skin. Like, he is so perfectly okay with being Paul McCartney at this point. It's sort of, I can't stop looking at him. It's like, how did you get this? How are you so comfortable? Why aren't you nervous? Why aren't you cross? Why aren't you, you know, he's just an amazingly zen dude by this point. Or he certainly gives that impression anyway.
Mm.
Yeah, very grounded.
Oh, very much so, yeah. Yeah, you think of the Phil Spector, all the pomp and the huge orchestration and choirs and the Disney slush. And then you look at this and it's just the four boys in Savile Row and Linda and Heather laying on the floor.
Yeah.
And it's just like you say, it's the family. It gives the whole song a much warmer feel.
It's like you've never heard it before, because I think I certainly didn't imagine listening to this song up until watching this film. I would have never have pictured that scene, the kind of the tired kid snoozing next to her mum, and just, yeah, the whole vibe is so small and warm and lovely. And just before they go into the take, George is being a bit mischievous and he gets the guitar pickup and like puts it against his throat and kind of makes this really incredible noise. It's like, why didn't someone say, hey, let's put a pinhole? That's really good. Let's do something with that. That's a weird sound. But he's just mucking around like with his vocal cords and guitar pickup. And it's just like funny. And then it just goes into this really beautiful, paired back, simple take of the song. And oh, yeah, it's very, very lovely to listen to it and to see them all. Again, it's like you just want to know that the beat, just for that moment, just for that, those few, they were all right. They did like each other and they still liked playing together. And it was all right. It's okay. I just needed it. Probably when I watched it, you just need to know that dynamic existed and they were really good together. Even then, when, you know, perhaps history suggested, you know, oh, it was awful. They were breaking up. Blah, blah, blah. No, this is really special. It's really precious.
Oh, it really is. Mm. The big thing that they're working on at the moment is no overdubs. They're just going to be au naturel and record everything as it is.
Yeah.
And when they go into the control room to listen to this take, again, Heather's on Paul's shoulders. And George suggests that the song maybe needs tidying up.
Yeah.
And there's a real bit of an awkward moment.
Yeah.
Because George Martin says, well, Paul's thinking of having strings on it anyway.
Yeah.
And George says, Paul, are you going to have strings? Yeah. Paul's like, I don't know.
I know. And
there's been a little of a chat.
Exactly. It's sort of like, it's this very, suddenly very, even more informal, but they're kind of all, the control room's small. They're sat, most of them, around chairs or on the floor. So it's a very kind of, you know, it's quite hard to see how they'd even get a camera in there, but they're in a very confined space. And Paul has, by this point, Heather's a monkey climbing all over him and sort of talking to Glyn Johns sort of off, out of shot. And there's one brilliant moment where Linda just, she's super cool, like in a way that I was, you know, when I had a little kid, I was always like, oh God, you know, don't be embarrassing. Shh, quiet. No, that man's talking. Be quiet, Doug, be quiet, be quiet. And she's just very, very zen. And at one point, Heather says something a bit too loudly and she just taps a little finger on her and goes, oh, and that's that. But she's such an hands-off kind of cool parent. But in this very confined space, yeah, they're trying to have quite an important discussion about, oh, so hang on, you're talking about strings, maybe brass, like what? Hang on, whoa. But even then, it feels mildly awkward. It doesn't feel like, oh, underlying tensions are coming to the surface. It just feels like they're going to sort this out. But they have got different ideas about, what they want.
What I love is the fact that George Martin, he keeps saying, yes, it's got a nice feel, and it needs something a little more clinical. So what that's saying to me is George Martin wants to do the score for this.
Literally. And he's quite the diplomat, isn't he? But that word clinical, that's carrying a lot. It's like what we've just witnessed is basically a bunch of guys with long hair lying around, kind of like, you know, lazily riffing, and then occasionally sort of just being a bit more switched on recording, and suddenly he's like clinical, and he's like, whoa, hang on, wait, this is 1969, man, what do you mean clinical? It's quite an interesting word to throw into the mix in this very informal environment.
Another idea they come up with as well, which again they should have done, was like a gospel at the beginning with the harmonies all going the long and winding.
Beautiful.
Just have all those gospel harmonies on that. Oh, that would have been
honestly
good.
Just you can hear it now, can't you? And it's just it's transporting. It's just, oh, gorgeous.
So Heather's still on Paul's shoulders combing his hair.
She is.
And Linda appears to be starving because she's saying she wants to go home and eat food for 3 hours till 1 p.m.
Yeah.
Paul says to Heather, you're just going to get back in your box. That's where you're going.
It's really funny. I mean, there's just a clear sense that, like, it's been really fun, kid, but and she looks like she's too old for like afternoon naps, but it's definitely, that was fun, but, you know, it's, and I love you, but you need to bugger off now because, you know, you're getting a bit overtired. again, done with affection and warmth and love, it's definitely like he's sort of laughing. She's kind of giving him like a proper sort of centre parting and like really combing his hair down. Still impossible to make him look anything other than beautiful, obviously. But it's definitely like a, all right, come on, you've had your fun, off you go sort of thing. Again, they seem like a really normal family. Like, go on, go off with your mum now. I mean, I got the impression, maybe Paul was saying they were all going, but I got the impression maybe they were carrying on working and it was time for, family time was fun, but now they need to perhaps make those important decisions about strings or no strings. Like, it was just a very human, normal, could you take the kid home now moment. It just felt, nice to sort of see that little insight. Yeah.
So, Julia, for a moment, imagine that you are Michael Lindsay Hogg.
Okay.
How would you feel at the end of this particular day about your project?
Like, absolutely delighted. I will get back in my box and just feel really happy with the day's work. I think it's one of the most, I mean, obviously there's lots and lots of what we talked about at the beginning, like that sort of constructive reality thing. There's quite a lot of tense stuff and the difficult dynamics of just being in a band. But this is for me, the bit of the whole film where you probably learn the most about the Beatles as people and where they fit into this group and where they fit into their own families. It's just useful to get a reference to who they are outside. Obviously, John, that's always hard with because he's just never on his own with his gang. He's always with Yoko. But I think there's so much emotional detail in this that it's the most satisfying for me. I just think I'd be really happy with it. I talked to a friend who is very purist, loves the Beatles very much, just doesn't care about the soap, wants the music, and he sees this as kind of an affront. I mean, he's a bit of a hardliner. He sees this as sort of an affront to, you know, I don't want the Beatles, the reality show, like, why are they doing this? It's not about the people. It's like, I don't care about their relationships. It's like, well, everybody else does. It's really interesting. Like, we can't deny we're human beings and we're interested in these stories. But it's such an odd, I remember like just watching the opening sort of half hour when it came out and it taking a while to really get used to just the audio mix and the kind of the way you're receiving it. Knowing like a friend of ours who's done some editing of other Beatles material, knowing that they've digitally pulled a voice out, and rather than it being in the hubbub and the mix, it's been solo on that track, and you're watching, it's so sort of hard to fall into the rhythm of it initially, but once you're in, and you kind of, it's very seductive. You feel like you're just in the room hanging out with them. I'll be amazed if someone isn't currently mapping the Apple Building in Savile Row for VR, or you want to, you know, or the soundstage where they started, because you wanted to stick a VR helmet on and be like one of the Hare Krishna guys at the side, just like tinging some bells and watching them record. Like, you feel like you're in there. It's quite amazing, but it's strangely artificial at the same time. That was a longer answer than you were looking for. But overall, liked it. Two Macca thumbs. That's what I'm giving it.
Julia Rayside, thank you so much.
Thank you. Hey, hey, hey.